I predicted the global financial crisis because, unlike mainstream economists, I focus on the role of credit in the economy, the role of private debt as well. And looking at both, I saw that private debt in America in about 2005 was 150% of GDP, and it was rising very quickly. The rate of growth of debt peaked at equivalent to 15% of GDP in 2006. So looking forward from when I first started warning about this in December of 2005, I said that that rate of growth of credit cannot be sustained. At some point, the level of private debt will cease rising. And when it ceases rising, rather than credit just falling and becoming smaller than it was in the past, we're likely to see credit turning negative. Now, that's what actually happened during the global financial crisis. So credit, the increase in private debt peaked at being equivalent to 15% of GDP in the middle of 2006, and it fell to minus 5% in 2009. That's what caused the downturn then. Now, this time round, it's not credit that's causing the trouble. It's what you have to do to sustain a level of credit, and that is you've got to continue servicing existing debt. When individuals take out debt or companies take out debt, they've got to service it out of their cash flow. So workers will have wages they try to pay their mortgages out of. Companies will have profits they try to pay their corporate debt out of. Until the war began, that was fairly sustainable because the economy had survived the global financial crisis. It had obviously been affected by, but we hadn't fallen into a Great Depression. So the economy was effectively ticking over when 2020 hit, continue being feasible for individuals to service their mortgages and for companies to service their corporate debt, with two things coming our way: the impact of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz with the El Nino, which is almost within weeks of starting. Those two factors, but certainly starting with Trump's stupid war, the supply shortages that's going to cause are just about to start hitting the American economy. So there won't be as enough fertilizer as there normally is for American crops, though Americans do create some of their own fertilizer. There won't be the helium, sulfuric acid, are the main impacts upon the manufacturing sector. Again, the next few months, we're going to find that companies that need helium for their production processes and their workflows, and that's the high-tech industry, magnetic resonance imaging in hospitals and so on, they won't have the helium anymore to enable those to happen, so those production processes will stop. You won't be able to create the copper anymore without the sulfuric acid, and that's one point where the Persian Gulf is absolutely critical, because the oil around the Persian Gulf has a high level of sulfur content. They call it sour in the trade, and that means that when you refine it, you've got to take the sulfur out of the oil to make it usable. And when you do that, you generate lots of sulfur dioxide, and that's what's used to make sulfuric acid. And sulfuric acid is then involved in so many manufacturing processes. But the easiest one to identify there is making copper. You have to use sulfuric acid to refine to get copper in the first instance. Copper is critical for data centers. We're going to lose about half the world's supply of sulfuric acid. So at some point, that means firms that produce copper that have to use sulfuric acid to do it, and they've got corporate debt. They won't be able to sell. The increase in the price will not make up for the fall in the volume, so they won't be able to service their debt as easily. Companies that rely upon sulfuric acid for their production processes won't get it, so they will also be unable to service their interest payments. So the combination is likely to mean a whole pattern across the entire country, entire globe, really, of individuals and companies that can no longer service the level of private debt. That means that in that case, they're going to start accumulating bad debt. They quite possibly will be foreclosed upon. That will run through the rest of the economy. So we're likely to see a financial crisis coming out of this ridiculous war, not caused by a boom and bust in the financial sector, but caused by the physical economy going bust, courtesy, first of all, of the war, and then secondly, of the El Nino. So those two effects are likely to mean a totally new form of global financial crisis. It's going to be a global supply crisis, which manifests in the financial sector because so many companies, so many individuals are carrying high levels of private debt. That's where we're going to see the shock. So we will have a financial crisis, but ironically, for once, it won't be caused by the financial sector. It'll be caused by Trump's adventurism in the war, and then what's going to happen with the impact of the El Nino when that comes through to it later in the year. We were in for a classic capitalist boom and bust sequence anyway with artificial intelligence, because AI as a new technology is on the scale of the impact of railways back in the 19th century. It's hard for us to imagine this. Back in the 1800s, trains were high tech. It's a technology you needed to have your economy to catch up with more advanced economies. So railways were the high tech of its day. Railways were first invented. Everybody saw huge profits, so there was a huge proliferation of companies building railroads and building steam engines and so on as well. And that caused a huge boom, but then there was massive overinvestment. And this is a classic thing in a capitalist economy, because when you have a new technology like railway and now like AI, all the firms that go into it have the ambition of being the dominant player in the industry. So therefore, you get a level of overinvestment. If every firm going in hopes they're going to become the monopolist for that industry sector, then you're going to get 5 and 10 times as much investment as is actually warranted by the appeal, because they're all going to hope that they're the survivor and the other 90% fail. Now, in fact, what normally happens is 10% survive, 90% do fail, and you therefore have a boom and a bust sequence. So the boom is going on right now. Heavy AI spending for building data centers and building up artificial intelligence software and so on is stimulating the economy. Well, if this video has alerted you to the fact that what you thought you knew about economics is wrong, you'll thoroughly enjoy the free book bundle that has been requested by over 5,000 people already. It's worth $50, but it's free right now. Click on the link in the description or go to stevekeen.com. And click on the black button and fill in your information. In about 60 seconds, you'll get the free book bundle. And after that, if you want to study with me personally and use my proprietary software, Revel, there'll be an invite to join that course as well. And what will then happen is that as this technology starts to really affect the rest of the economy, so you start using AI to take the place of legal assistance, you use AI as a diagnostic tool, you have AI being used in robotics, as that starts to happen, it will actually depress other parts of the economy. When a new technology comes in, it stimulates the economy. When it starts being developed and sold, it undercuts the previous technologies, and then it'll cause a slump. And this is the best person on this to explain was Joseph Schumpeter, way back in the early 1900s, with a wonderful book called The Theory of Economic Development. And he basically explained this boom and bust cycle and said that's endemic to capitalism. So we're seeing another version of it with the AI. That means we have this initial stage where there's massive investment that stimulates the economy, and not just in the strictly speaking AI sectors, but the people who are learning that money then buy other things with it, so they stimulate other parts of the economy as well. So we're in that stage at the moment. When the technology comes online, if it really is effective, it undercuts existing technologies and causes a slump. And then, as it happens, the technology gets embedded in society during the slump period. That's something you can see with the internet, for example. So we had the big internet bubble up to and including 2001. There was then the bust in the American stock market in 2001, where the market fell 14% in one day when the bubble finally went out of steam. And so there were many, many companies, like, for example, Pets.com. You know, Pets.com was going to take over the food distribution market for pets. Well, have you shopped at Pets.com? No, you haven't, because it was one of the many companies that went bust. But of course, can you imagine the world without the internet these days? It has permeated all of society. So Schumpeter's argument was the boom begins with some technological advance, which means the company that creates that technology gets a lead over all the others, but it's got to invest to get there. The investment stage causes a boom. Then when the product starts rolling out, it undercuts existing industries and causes a slump. And then in that stage, the technology becomes integrated into society overall. That's the basic pattern. Now, with AI, it looks like the scale of investment compared to the potential revenue streams is wrong by a factor of at least about 10. When you look at the costs of AI companies versus the revenues, you're often looking at a ratio of 10 to 1. So they're making losses now, and the belief is they'll make profits in the future. But just like that happened with the internet bubble, the expectations of profit were far larger than the sector could actually sustain. We're still about to see that break come through. There's also the wild card of what will happen if China produces a cheaper version of AI than America can manage. That seems to be a large part of the focus of the Chinese, is to make it use less energy and be cheaper, and be running AI on your own computer rather than needing a data center. They may have a slump the overinvestment boom might be followed for a slump where all those investments become obviously worthless because the Chinese don't need the data centers on the same scale the Americans do. It may be Chinese companies that dominate AI. The remaining Americans don't make anything like the revenue they expect. So we're in for, a fascinating period. We're starting to see this turning up already in the price that's being charged for the tokens that are part of an AI system. At the moment, that price is well below the cost of using the energy in those data centers that perform the calculations for you. At some point, those prices are going to go up. The number of people using AI will fall fairly dramatically, and AI will then be focused just in the industries where it does things that we really can't do any other way. But before the period of the slump in AI actually starts, but that's the outcome I expect. So we're going to get a slump out of AI. It's still going to have an impact and permeate through society, but nowhere near as widely as most of the AI advocates thought. They're not making revenue out of it, but they're letting people, create cartoons using AI and charging them one-tenth of the cost effectively to make the cartoons. Well, the cartoons are going to go. There will still be serious uses for AI, and it will settle down into those uses, but it might be one-tenth the scale of the economic impact that people originally thought it would have because they've invested 10 times as much as they should have. Well, the warning indicators in terms of the slump we're about to face are the Strait of Hormuz and when the oil stocks start running out. So one of the reasons that oil prices didn't rise as much as people thought they would initially is that China has reserves of the order of 1.5 billion barrels of oil. So America has a strategic reserve measured in millions of barrels, and China's got them measured in billions of barrels. So by running down its stock, it actually suppressed the increase in price caused by the cutoff in supplies that has already occurred. But they're now restocking. They're now back in restocking that particular, building up the stock that they ran down to do that early. Neoclassical theory will tell you markets are forward-looking. Well, BS to that. They tend to react to the spot market dynamics, and because of China's running down of its reserves and the same of America, there hasn't been much of an increase in the oil prices. When the stocks run out and the flow of supply is also cut off because of the cutting of the Strait of Hormuz, then we're going to have a dramatic fall in the availability of oil, and that will then affect production processes all across the globe. It'll make, obviously, the oil price will rise, but the main thing is there simply won't be the availability of oil to sustain the level of economic activity. And this is one of the areas where the mainstream is completely wrong because they don't realize the role of energy in production. Now, that might sound crazy to you if you're not an economist, and frankly, it is crazy, because when you take a look at the relationship between energy and GDP, it's virtually a one-for-one relationship. Okay, so this is a RAVL file showing both energy and gross world product for the global economy. It's taken in from the world energy balances from the International Energy Association and GDP measures from the World Bank. And when you plot energy in petajoules and against gross world product in 2015 US dollars, you find they're virtually the same straight line. But even more significantly, the change in energy and the change in gross world product are virtually identical. The scale is the same. So there's a 4% increase in gross world product, there's a 4% increase in energy. If there's a fall in one, there's a fall in the other. You can see the impact of COVID there. Now, COVID was clearly a case of the gross world product falling because suddenly there's lockdowns and people can't work anymore, and energy consumption fell lockstep with that. Equally, you've got things like the OPEC price rise in terms of the impact that had on the economy back in the mid to late 1970s, and you can see that there was a boom and then a bust, and that was caused by the energy effect. So energy can drive. If energy goes down, so does gross world product. If gross world product goes down, so does energy. They're basically lockstep with each other. Now, that is completely missing from mainstream economics. So they're not even aware of the role of energy and what in enabling GDP produced. And if you ask economists what's going to be the impact of, say, a 10% fall in the availability of energy, that will cause a 0.4% fall in gross world product. Now, that's obviously not true on the data, but it's in their models that this is one of the problems. They have models that are not tested against the data in any realistic sense. So this is the real world. You can see that the relationship between energy and gross world product is virtually one for one. If energy changes, gross world products change by the same amount and vice versa. That's the actual data. But according to their models, they claim that because energy is only equivalent to about 4% of the total of GDP, then a fall in availability of energy will cause a 0.04 fall in GDP. The change in output, given a change in energy, is equal to the fraction that the particular sector has of GDP. So the energy sector is about 4% of GDP. So they're therefore saying that if there's, well, 4% is equal to 0.04 as a fraction. What they're saying is if there's a 10% fall in energy availability, which is 0.1 in decimal terms, that'll cause a 4% fall in GDP, which is 0.04 in fractional terms, and therefore it's pretty trivial. 10% fall in energy, only a 0.4% fall in the rate of economic growth. So we can forget about it pretty much. That is complete nonsense. The real world is 10% fall in energy, you'll have a 10% fall in GDP. Why do they make that mistake? And it comes back to how they think about production, because the way that neoclassical economists model production is to multiply together capital and labor and energy proportionally to their shares of GDP. Capital gets about 25% of GDP, labor gets about 70%, energy gets about, say, 5%. Those are the arguments that the neoclassicals have in their production model, and that therefore means that if one falls, you only get a small. So the fall that if one of capital or labor or energy fall in the quantity, then you'll get a tiny fractional impact of that upon GDP. Whereas the approach that I use, which comes from post-Keynesian economics and is called the Leontief production function under the in honor of the person who first found this empirical relationship, basically says you can't substitute inputs. So if you don't have the capital, or you don't have the labor, or you don't have the energy, if there's a fall in energy, you can't substitute it by adding more workers. That's the basic logic there. So if you compare these two and say what happens according to these two models if there's a fall in the availability of energy, then if I reduce the availability of energy here by 1%, you can see that the neoclassical model says our production is still going to be 99.9% of the previous level, whereas the approach that I take said it's going to fall by 1%. And if you push it through to, say, a 10% fall, which is what we're expecting, at least in terms of the decline in energy coming from the Strait of Hormuz, the neoclassical model says that that will only reduce GDP by 0.5%, which you're seeing over here. But the post-Keynesian model says it's going to fall. If energy availability falls by 10%, then GDP is going to fall by 10%. And then the only way you can get a catastrophic fall out of the neoclassical model is everything has to disappear. I've got a 10% fall in energy. If I add in a 10% fall in machinery and a 10% fall in labor, then I finally match what the post-Keynesian model says is going to happen. That's basically treating capital and labor and energy as substitutes. It's as if you don't have any petrol, you can put your kids into the petrol tank. I'm sorry, you can't. So this sees these inputs as substitutes, whereas the approach that I take sees them as complements. If you don't have one of those three inputs, then you can't produce the output. So a 10% fall in any of those sectors will cause a 10% fall in GDP. We're facing a 10% fall in energy availability. That implies a 10% fall in gross world products is coming our way.